So, text 67, continuing with the king. With respect to the affairs, let the ambassador explore the expression of the countenance, the gestures and actions of the foreign king, through the gestures and actions of his confidential advisers, and discover his design amongst his servants. Having learned exactly from his ambassador the designs of the foreign king, let the king take such measures that he does not bring evil on himself. So the king must protect himself, because he is the one who's protecting the people. So if the king is not maintained, if he loses his position, then then he cannot protect the people. So it's his business to make sure that nothing is going to happen to himself or his people by the foreign king. 69. Let him settle in a country which is open and has a dry climate, where grain is abundant, which is chiefly inhabited by Aryans, not subject to epidemic diseases or similar troubles, and pleasant, where the vassals are obedient and his own people easily find their livelihood. So one should find some place that is very proper for the people. Means it is, if it's not good for the people, the inhabitants, what's the use? The whole purpose is to protect one's own people. So if the place is not good for these people, then it's not a good place to settle. So one may ask, well, how does, one is you can find out from just what is going on there. Two is you can tell by also through the shastras, through the vastu. The vastu can tell you where the different elements are, your mountains, your rivers, your lakes, your highland, your lowland, the types of trees, the types of land that is there, and they can tell you whether it's suitable or not. So just by, if one understands this science, one can tell if this will be good or not. 70. But one should always remember that nothing's perfect, right? You know, like Jaipur, they have certain aspects. The place cannot be conquered because of where they put their gates, this and that. They also have great opulence. It's a very rich place. People come from all over the world. But at the same time, it has a fault, is that there will be no male issue in the family. So there's no prince. There's never a prince. They only have daughters. So they always have to bring in from somewhere else. Like that. I mean, somebody else marries and then that kingdom becomes theirs. So this has been, you know, for some time like that.
Is that a curse or something?
I think there's a curse involved, but just that these things come up generally is also there with the vastu. So, like that. So the point is it's not, otherwise I may say this thing, then devotees will hear and think, oh, vastu, I'll learn that and make my life, you know, wonderfully, materially perfect. But it can never be perfect. That's the problem, right? That's the thing, you know? Something tastes very nice, it's not necessarily good for health, right? It's good for health, it doesn't necessarily taste nice, you know? So, like that, you know, you can't win. But at least in the case, the king looks to see that the people aren't going to be disturbed by these things. Has a good climate. There's plenty of grains, it's easily available, people can easily make their living, and there's no difficulties, you know, just a big proportion, epidemics like this. You know, small diseases, you can't get around, but epidemics. And it is chiefly inhabited by Aryans. So Aryans means those who are interested in God consciousness. Otherwise, what's the use? 70. Let him build there a town, making for his safety a fortress, protected by a desert, or a fortress built of stone and earth, or one protected by water or trees, or one formed by an encampment of armed men or a hill fort. Yeah. So, in other words, they build a town, and in this there should be a fortress. So that can either be on top of a mountain, in the middle of water, in the middle of a desert, means it's a very big place, so then no one can easily get to the king. Or so many trees are there, because if there's a lot of trees, they can't shoot arrows, they can't do so many things. You know, they have to take, if they really want to be serious, they have to take the trouble to pull down the whole forest. Not that they don't do that, but that's what trouble they'll have to take. It won't be easy for them. Like that. Or one form an encampment of armed men. So that would mean you'd have to build it, the city, in such a way that it has an army always around it. So this has to be seen also. And that, so that means the fort would have to be built large enough that the army can live inside it, all around. 71. Let him take every effort to secure a hill fort, for amongst all those fortresses mentioned, a hill fort is distinguished by many superior qualities. Yeah. The first three of those, various kinds of fortresses, are inhabited by wild beasts, animals living in holes, and aquatic animals. The last three by monkeys, men, and gods, respectively. So that means protected by a desert, built of stone or earth, or protected by water or trees. Then you're going to have wild beasts, animals living in holes, and aquatic animals if you have moats. Then the last three. Yeah. Trees. You're going to have monkeys. Encampment of your army is going to be men. And the hill fort is the gods. So therefore, of all of them, then residing there, better to have the gods with you than monkeys or, you know, some fish or animals that live in holes, like that. 73. As enemies do not hurt these beings when they are sheltered by their fortresses, even so, foes cannot injure a king who has taken refuge in his fort. 74. One bowman placed on a rampart is a match in battle for 100 foes. 100 for 10,000, and hence it is prescribed in the Shastras that a king shall possess a fortress. So the hill fortress here, and then when he is on a rampart, means these are those areas where the stone is there and you have a very thin slit, and from there, you know, it has an angle so they can shoot in any direction. So one good bowman there is a match in a battle for 100 bowmen on the other side. He is up, they are down, they're in the open. He only has this small slit. So that means from far away they have to be able to get it through there. So one man can take care of 100. Or it says 100 for 10,000. So therefore, the Shastras say a king should have a fortress. 75. Let that fort be well supplied with weapons, money, grain, and beasts of burden, with brahmanas, with artisans, with engines, with fodder, and with water. Engines means catapults and all these kind of, you know, nice machineries that... Okay. So that means it should have all things to protect. It should have money so one can maintain everything nicely. And it must have Brahmins who are going to advise and do all kinds of auspicious activities there. Artisans, because then they can nicely entertain people and create a nice atmosphere. And fodder and water. These are very important. Water. If there's no water, natural water, then very easily one can be driven from one's fort. You have to have an internal water supply. So on mountains also, you see generally rivers come out of mountains. So you pick a mountain that also has its own water. Then you are secure. 76. Let him cause to be built for himself in the center of it a spacious palace, well protected, habitable in every season, resplendent with whitewash, supplied with water and trees. So it should be very, very nicely built and well, you know, very attractive, like that. And it should be, how you say, in every season. So one should consider all the different aspects. The king should have different rooms that work for different seasons. You have your verandas and high ceilings for the summer. You have your smaller, more closed rooms for your winter. So the point is he must be comfortable at all time. Because if there's comfort, then that's one less anxiety. Right? The anxiety is going to be there that he's managing the whole kingdom. So that creates a lot of difficulty. So at least there should be some simple comfort so that the mind can work at its best. That's always important to remember at this, because one will say, well, then the king may be, you know, into his own sense gratification. But they're only doing this because of the king. The day that the son is ready to sit on the throne, that day they put on birch bark and walk out of the palace with nothing. They leave behind that town that they built, the fortress that they built, the wealth they've collected, the army that they've amassed, all the economic development, they walk out with nothing. That is a kshatriya. If they walk out with, well, I did this and I built that and I should get this, then they're not talking about a kshatriya like that. Kshatriya walks out clean. Therefore, we can understand that actually it's not for his own senses. Because when he goes, he doesn't take the air conditioner with him. He built the nice office, the nice desk, the phone, the fax, the computer with the color monitor, and all these different things. And then when his service changes, he doesn't take it with him. If he takes it with him, that was the sign, that's why he's leaving that service, because he wasn't fit to do that service in the first place. He wasn't a leader like that. He was not a kshatriya. Kshatriya, the next person needs it. Why he should take it with him? If he amassed that, if he has any ability, he goes to another service, he can amass that also. But he knows that to do this service, he needs that facility. Why he won't leave that for the next person? Right? So they improve the situation. Just like a Brahmin, when he goes into a place, he makes it more clean than when he was there before. He goes in, and if it's not clean, he'll clean the place and then use it. So when he leaves, it's cleaner. So the next person's a benefit. He doesn't walk in, it's dirty, and he just, ooh, this is a dirty place, because it'll be cleaned. Like that. That's a Brahmin. So a Kshatriya comes in, creates the atmosphere for economic development and protection and shelter, and then when he moves to another service, he leaves that behind for the next person who's going to do it. So these are Brahmins and Kshatriyas. They work by the Shastra. They're not worried about themselves personally. Like that. It's very important. It's a small point. It's a very important point. Otherwise, it's, well, he has so much facility. Why he should have? But when he moves and the next person comes, that facility will all be left. Like that. Nothing goes. Okay. 77. Inhabiting that, let him wed a consort of equal varna, who possesses auspicious marks on her body and is born in a great family, who is charming and possesses beauty and excellent qualities. So then he should have a proper wife who can also be able to work within that palace, because she'll be taking care of the place. Like not Kunti, Krishna's mother, Devaki. When she was married, she got 2,000 maidservants came with her. You might think, what do 2,000 maidservants do? Who do you think cleans the palace? You got a palace, you got a lot of things to wash, clean, sweep, wipe, your curtains and all the linens and moving things around. It's a lot of work. So she takes that and she manages that. So it's no small thing. One may say, women are good managers. Yes, those who are really good managers, then they would manage palaces, right? They're not managing the kingdom, that the husband does. You can imagine managing 2,000 servants. That's no small management, you know? And to be able to do it in a refined way and keep everything very perfect, so that all the other people of refined culture and that understand this is a very, high-class palace, high-class kingdom, high-class family. So it's big management. Big management. 78. Let him appoint a domestic priest, Puruhit, and choose officiating priests, Ritviks. They shall perform his domestic rites and the sacrifices for which three fires are required. So you have the domestic priest, who is the one who's going to give advice. He's the priest, he's going to set all the timings, he's going to do everything, give advice, what should be done, not done, according to Shastras, everything. Then he's going to have other ones who are going to do officiating priests, who are going to do all the different rituals. They're going to perform the rituals and all that. So at the performance, yeah. And so together they perform the ritualistic domestic rites. So generally the domestic priest, he's called the Acharya, or the Brahma priest. And then you have three others, the Hota, or Hotri, the Advayu, who sets everything up, the Udgatri, who chants the mantras, and the Hotri is the one who pours the ghee. He does this, invokes the, how you say, installs the fire, and does the offerings. And then the domestic priest, he will see that it's going on nicely. Or if he's not, he's just not involved, advising the king, stays with the king. Then if there's not a Brahma priest, then the Hotri, he oversees it and officiates, so therefore he's called the Ritvik. This is where the term comes from. The Ritvik means he was officiating on someone else's behalf here. So then he does all these things. But strangely enough, the Ritvik is awarded very high honor and respect. Even he gets Madhuparka and all these different things that generally we think of only for the deity. So while they are doing that service, they are respected as good as God. Madhuparka is a mixture of generally honey, ghee, and yogurt. And it is used at very special, very formal receptions. Like a king, the priest, and maybe the father or father-in-law, the bridegroom. These are all offered Madhuparka. Bridegroom just one time when he gets that married by the father-in-law. The others, if they're coming after 1 year. If they're coming after 1 year, then you can offer Madhuparka. That means it's a very elaborate reception. When Madhuparka is there, it means everything else is there. It would be like saying rolling out the red carpet. Like that. If you're offering Madhuparka, then all the other small things like washing the feet, giving the seat, offering argya, that's all there. Madhuparka is the more elaborate aspect of it. So that will be offered to all these personalities. So I mean, even the father-in-law's being offered, the bridegroom. So it's a special thing, but we see that it's very broad. When there's very nice formal respect, it's used. It's not some uncommon thing. Sometimes, because being from the West, we many times, these are very unusual to us. So therefore, we see only this kind of worship is being offered to the spiritual master, you know, and specifically the one who gives diksha. But in the Vedic culture, you know, it would be even offered to the bridegroom by the father of the girl. So, I mean, it's there, just like washing the feet. We'll nowadays only wash the feet generally of the gurus. When Prabhupada is here, it would be the sannyasis or any senior devotee. And we see in Krishna Lila, Sudama Brahman comes. Just a Brahman comes, they'll wash the feet. But not having a concept in the Western, culture of formal respect based on duty, that there's worship. We'll only worship if they're, you know, a big movie star or like that, and then we'll get their autograph or roll on the ground or scream and, you know, something like that, you know. Then that's okay. But formal, dutiful, respectful, then according to the Western concept, that's not good. That's improper, you know. Who is this person? But, you know, you have some big, you know, musician come, and if, you know, thousands and thousands of people are out there and yelling and screaming and trying to get their autograph and fainting and all that, then everyone will think, oh, this is very nice. So the guy's made it in life, right? But if you have someone and out of respect, you know, official according to the scriptures, then that's bogus. You know, this is nonsense. Who do these people think they are? It's very interesting. Because the one is a festival of sense gratification. And the other one is then proper respect for authority. So we see the Western paradigm is the authority is generally not respected. But sense gratification is. That's fine. You know? That's quite okay. So it's interesting that these aspects of the culture are there and that they're respected very nicely when they're performing those duties. Then when they're not performing, then they'll be awarded the respect of a Brahmin, of a priest, but they don't get so much official respect. That's just when they're performing the activity. Like that. 79. A king shall offer various Shrauta sacrifices at which liberal fees are distributed, and in order to acquire merit, he shall give to Brahmanas enjoyments and wealth. So it mentions here liberal fees. Kings are always supposed to be liberal, because it's always expected. The father is very liberal with the children, you know, the lord with the devotees, so the king with his subjects and the Brahmins, like that. And he must always, give facilities to the Brahmins. Brahmins are living simply, but then qualified Brahmins are then called and they're fed and given facility and given charity like this. 80. Let him cause the annual revenue in his kingdom to be collected by trusty officials. Let him obey the sacred law in his transactions with the people and behave like a father towards all men. Right, so this is the annual revenue, once a year it can be collected, not more than that, because that's when the harvests and everything come in, because this is the real revenue is grains. Because then you can eat it, you can eat the revenue, right? That then it's actual has use. And then let him obey the sacred law in his transactions with the people. It means he himself cannot transgress the law. This is the important thing. The divine right of kings means that they are not necessarily judged by the people. They're judged by people that are equal and above them. But it doesn't mean that they can break the law or they make up their own law. This is a misinterpretation. They follow the law. They themselves follow and they give example. If they don't follow, why anyone else will follow? Krishna comes, he follows the law. So he says if he didn't follow, no one would follow. So if the king doesn't follow, why his citizens will follow? 81. For the various branches of business, let him appoint intelligent supervisors. They shall inspect all the acts of those men who transact his businesses. So if there's different businesses to generate money for the state, then he shall have supervisors who will watch these things, how they will check all these things, and let them run it. He doesn't get involved. He sees that they're qualified and then lets them run. Like yesterday, the ministers, he gives them their space to work. But he checks and sees they're getting results and they were qualified before they start. And he sees that they maintain that. 82. Let him honor those brahmanas who have returned from their teacher's house after studying the Veda. For that money which is given to brahmanas is declared to be an imperishable treasure for kings. So brahmanas who have finished, returned from the teacher's house, this is the snataka, means one who has graduated. Because they graduate when they finish their studies. They weren't qualified to study, then the teacher wouldn't have taken them in the first place. Maximum they can keep them in the school for 1 year. Then after a year they have to say, I can teach you or not. You are qualified to learn or not. So that aspect, like we discussed yesterday, is that qualification of the junior, the dependent, must also be seen. It's not enough just to look at the leaders must be qualified. Also, those who follow must be qualified. If they're not qualified, how you'll lead? Right? You give the best leader and you give him a bunch of unqualified people, what he'll do with them? You know? What it'll do with them. So here is, therefore, the Brahman who has returned from the teacher's house means he has been trained nicely. And such a person is to be respected. So that's the snatak. And it says that money given to such brahmanas is declared to be imperishable treasure for kings. Because if you give money to just a beggar, whatever you gave, you'll get back the same amount. You give it to a brahman, the right time, right place, then you'll get back so much more. If you give to a very highly qualified, learned brahman, then you'll get a huge amount, right? It means the brahmachari comes, he's a brahman. You give to him, you'll get a lot back. But you give to one who has studied, finished their studies, and is qualified, then you get back a huge amount. So it's imperishable. And if we understand brahmana as devotee, then they get an unlimited amount. Like that. You give to the qualified devotees, then the return is unlimited. Therefore, it says imperishable treasure. Two is, one is devotional service, and two, just for maintaining the kingdom and that, then so much is there. So this is another key issue. If one wants to increase economic development, then charity should be given to qualified brahmanas, and, you know, charity, feeding of them, and taking care of them, like this. That is very important. Taking care of the cows, right? Seeing that the education is going on nicely, so you do get qualified brahmins coming out of the educational system. Like this. These are the ways in the Vedic age how they would acquire merit. They would acquire economic development. When dharma is there, then artha is natural. 83. Neither thieves nor foes can take it, nor can it be lost. Hence an imperishable store must be deposited by kings with brahmanas. Means that whatever you give, whatever you'll get back, means you've given to a brahman. What you will get in return for that, nobody can take that from you. It's not possible. It says here, thieves or foes, no one can take it. Therefore, if one is actually serious about economic development, this is the process. Because otherwise, you do business, you know, the dacoits can take it, your own people who work in the business will take it, the government will take it, you know, your partners will take it, you know, the kids will take it, you know, somebody will take it. But this return can never be taken. Even if they try, it can't be taken. So therefore, in the Vedic system, they had desire, they knew actually how to fulfill it. The offering made through the mouth of a brahmana, which is neither spilt nor falls on the ground, nor ever perishes, is far more excellent than Agnihotras. In other words, the Brahmanyahuta, offering nice foodstuffs to the mouth of the brahmana, that offering is better than the Agnihotras. These are one of the main five Mahayagyas, is Brahmanyahuta, feeding the brahmanas. So every grihastha is recommended to do that. Even we see the sages and that, they will also do it. If they're having a program, they will also feed. Like that. You see the Madhva sannyasis and that, they're feeding also. And they go around afterwards to the Brahmins, not to everybody, the Brahmins. They will give them some dakshin and give them cloth and everything like this. Because this is the best of all these. It's much better than Agnihotras. And we see that the Goswamis also, they'd have big festivals. They would also, when someone gives a donation, then generally what they would do is they would feed the devotees. Right? Somebody gives, what are they going to do with it? They live under a tree. They don't need any money. So they have a big festival and feed all the devotees. Like that. Then, yeah, we understand the only thing better than this is then, of sacrifices, is the chanting of the holy names. That's the best. Like that. But if we are feeding the devotees, associating the devotees for the purpose of spiritual upliftment, then that is in that same category of five. Though chanting is the most essential, and associating with devotees is the next. Then after that, worship of the deity, living in the holy dham, hearing Srimad Bhagavatam. like this, that the chanting of the holy name and associating with advanced devotees, these are the topmost of the topmost five. Of the five mukti activities, transcendental liberating activities, then those two are the best. So here we see is that associating with the brahmanas, because it's not you're just feeding. They're going to discuss, they're going to, you know, hear what they have to say. So when you have the brahmins, there's going to be discussion of philosophy. There's going to be hearing of the holy names. These activities are going to be going on. That's why it's so recommended. So a materialistic person will just see, oh, I feed the brahmins. So they make arrangements, people come, sit down, they eat, they go away. Okay, but that wasn't really the purpose. The real purpose was you bring them, sit them, you'll discuss some things, ask questions, and then when everything's ready, then you sit them down, feed them nicely, give them a place to rest. When they get up, generally be some more discussions, and then they'll go on their way. Therefore, the Shastra says, better than feeding hundreds of thousands of people, and you can't pay really good attention, better feed one person nicely. Right? And if you can feed a few more, do that. How many you can feed with full attention, taking care of all the needs, that many you should feed. You shouldn't think, oh, yes, you know, it's somebody's birthday, so let's feed, you know, 5,000 people, and then they don't get fed properly, and they don't get served properly, and all this. And then you think, yes, I have fed 5,000 people. No, you haven't fed 5,000. Because how many you get the credit for how many were satisfied. So if out of the 5,000, you know, then, you know, two or three servers were satisfied, then, you know, that's not the best offering. Here neither spilt nor falls. He also mentions here in the notes about not spoiled by hairs or insects falling into it. Also, I would take it from here, it's meaning that if it's spilt or it falls, means the service is not very good. So this would mean that the offering made to the mouth of the Brahmins means with full attention. It's full attention, then you're going to not be rushing or not doing things. You'll have proper utensils, you'll be actually conscious, and then when you offer it, it will do nicely. Because if it falls or spilt, means the service is not good. And then they're not going to be very satisfied, because the atmosphere is not good. That means it's wrong. So they'll eat, and then everything will maintain very formal. But if it's very nicely done, then they'll be very satisfied and give their blessings. Because the point is when the Brahmins are very satisfied, the Lord is satisfied. Because he accepts those offerings given through the mouth of the Brahmanas. He likes that very much. He's very pleased when you feed the Brahmins with all kinds of nice things. He likes that. 85. A gift to one who is not a Brahmana yields the ordinary reward. That means just the equal amount. A gift to one who calls himself a Brahmana, a double reward. A gift to a well-read Brahmana, 100,000-fold reward. A gift to one who knows the Veda and the Angas, Veda Parag, a reward without end. So here is what I was mentioning before. One who calls himself a Brahmana, this may also mean... Or one who calls himself a Brahmana, this can also just mean the Dwija, the Brahmachari who's just taken, but he's not studied yet. Yes. means that he's satisfied. It means if the Brahman is satisfied, the Lord's satisfied. So one is always trying to gain the Lord's satisfaction. One's trying to please the Lord. That's the, our whole idea. See, as a devotee is not worried about the material results. Right? These are just mentioned here that one understands how the material world functions. So we see that things done in relationship with the Lord give a good result. Things not done in relationship to the Lord give a bad result. So then the natural conclusion is I should follow the path set out by the Lord. The path given by the Lord and followed by the Mahajanas. That is the path I should take. Material, we're not worried about that. You know? It's just known that it's very nice. Someone may say it's very materialistic, but then also we go to a good spot on Sankirtan because there is, we get a good result. So someone could say, well, that's very materialistic. You know, why do you go down out on Christmas night and go down and, you know, sit in front of the shopping mall? You know, because you're just interested in getting more money, selling more books. But the point is the books going out are for Krishna, and the money coming in is for Krishna. So the whole point is that same understanding is applied to everything else. The result is Krishna's. So naturally you want to get a good result for Krishna. I have to give in charity. It's the natural purpose of a devotee, of a Brahmin. So I have more than what I need. So I must give in charity. So if I give it to someone very qualified, then that pleases the Lord. Why would they give more result? It pleases the Lord. Right? An ordinary person, that's nice. That's philanthropic work. Someone who's a dvija, then it gets double. Someone who's actually well-read, who has learned something like that, then it gives more. Gives 100,000. Means they've studied the Veda, they have knowledge, 100,000. Then one who knows the Vedas, its angas, how to apply it, means one who is realized, then unlimited. So why is that there? Because Krishna is satisfied.
Maharaj, what if you give to someone realizing that they're part and parcel of Krishna, and Krishna's in their heart, and you want to make them favorable to Krishna consciousness, then they've been led to it.
Then that's preaching. That's something there, but that's not so much the, how you say? That's more of a gift than charity. You know? Slight. Yeah, it's more. It's because they're getting the benefit. Because they're not so qualified. So they're not going to, that doesn't come on that platform. It'll come on the spiritual platform. Just like when you give to a devotee, here's giving unlimited, but unlimited on the material platform. But when you give to devotees, then it comes on the spiritual platform. Like that. Unless you want it on the material platform. If you're very interested in material development, you'll get that. You know, it's like you can perform devotional service and want material enjoyment and go to the heavenly planets. Krishna will arrange that. You know? But if you want to please Krishna and serve in pure devotion, then the rewards will come on the spiritual platform. So you can decide which currency you want it in. You know? It looks really big when you translate it into, you know, whatever it is. Lira or something like that. You know, you have $1 and you have, you know, it's hundreds of thousands of liras. So, I mean, it looks great, but you can't buy a whole lot with it. You know, so the same thing is, you can translate devotional service into pious results, material pious results, but the satisfaction won't be very much. Therefore, all these terms like this aren't attractive to the devotees. Therefore, when Narad Muni explains all this to Yudhishthir, he doesn't get into such detail. Because Yudhishthir is going to follow it anyway because it's Krishna's path. It's the way Krishna wants it done. He's going to do it. He's not worried about the results. So you don't have to put page after page showing the results. These are just to get people who have other motives to make sure that they follow Krishna's path. But we are reading it because devotees are talking so much about social economic development. And to the point that they'll use that term rather than varnashram. What they mean is varnashram, but what they want out of it is economic development. Therefore they say social economic development. They want a nice community with lots of money. You know, so these are results of dharma. Varnashram creates that. So it's like, you know, it's like saying, how you say? You're concentrating on the profit in the business. But if you go to any businessman and say, well, we want the profit, so we'll just concentrate and talk about profit. And he'll say, no, you have to talk business. And you do the business, you'll get the profit. Like that. But if you only talk about the profit, then that's like that man with the potter, and he had one clay pot. And he was thinking, I'll sell this pot, and then from that, then, you know, I will then get, you know, something, and then with that, then we'll get a cow, and then we'll get money, and this, and then, you know, he ends up with a huge, you know, facility and all this and that, and then in his own mind he starts an argument, you know, I think with his wife over how something be spent and this and that, and he's saying, no, it won't go like this, and he picks up a stick and swings it like that and breaks the pot. So then he has nothing. So like that is you have to sell the pot, then you make the profit. Like that. So the point is economic development means there's already dharma, because from dharma you get artha. If you're interested in artha, then one has to be intelligent and follow the process of dharma. If one is not interested in artha, means material, one wants spiritual artha, or going back to Godhead, then one still follows dharma. But now not for material artha, but for pleasing Krishna.
So for the devotee, dharma becomes bhakti, for the material,
yes,
becomes artha.
Yeah. So that's the thing, is when dharma is used in the Lord's service, then it is favorable to devotional service, it becomes devotional service. It's sad-dharma. That's the meaning, sad-dharma. You know, nāna-śastra-vichāra-naika-nipano, sad-dharma-samstāpako. So they're establishing all the codes of etiquettes, dealings, everything, for all the ashrams and all the aspects, and they refer also to the varnas, how it works. So they've gotten that from the Vedic literature. Right? The same Puranas and all these different places, Pancharatras and all that, to discuss dharma. But they've extracted those ones that are favorable for devotional service. So that dharma is called sad-dharma. And doing it for the purpose of pure love is called pure devotional service. Right? Shruti Smriti Puranadi Pancharatra Vidim Bhina. And if it's not in line with these books, it doesn't have any meaning. So sometimes it'll be said, oh, that's, you know, Vedic Maya nonsense. But if you're interested in material development, you have to go to the Vedas. Like that. Where else are you going to go? One has to go to the Vedas. And then it's nice. So all this is then given here. So this is just the culture. In other words, that one should encourage knowledgeable Brahmins. The king should encourage the Brahminical culture, especially those who are developed. Like that. Anybody. Means he's also giving in charity, feeding people, doing all welfare work. That's what Arjuna was saying, is that when the family tradition is destroyed, then all the welfare work of the family is uprooted. So, but that's not the most pleasing. It's done. Arjuna is doing it. He's a pure devotee of the Lord. Right, an eternal associate, but they're also doing all kinds of different activities. You know, like we're feeding food for life. It's a welfare activity. You're feeding people. That's what they see. But we know behind that is the prasad. So we're not worried about the good result, pious result we get from feeding people. That we're not worried about. We're not worried about, okay, we fed 10,000 people, so therefore, then, you know, I'll get fed from 10,000 people, you know? They're not worried about that kind of stuff. Like that. No one thinks about that. But at the same time, when you want to think about these things, this is where it comes from. It comes from the Lord. If we depend upon the Lord, then whatever we need, we'll get. Right? If we don't depend upon the Lord, we're not going to get. Verse 86, for according to the particular qualities of the recipient, and according to the faith of the giver, a small or great reward will be obtained for a gift in the next world. 87. A king who, while he protects his people, is defied by foes, be they equal in strength or stronger or weaker, must not shrink from battle, remembering the duty of Kshatriyas. Not to turn back in battle, to protect the people, to honor the Brahmins, is the best means for a king to secure happiness. Those kings who, seeking to slay each other in battle, fight with the utmost exertion and do not turn back. Those kings who, seeking to slay each other in battle, fight with the utmost exertion and do not turn back, go to heaven. Because to do like this, actually, fighting, it's they must understand they're not the body. You know, the hidden point behind this is one can only do that if one understands one's not the body. One can't fight in the utmost, even if one knows one's going to be defeated, and not be afraid, unless one knows one's not the body. So the kings know they're not the body. Well, they're in this body, and they take advantage of the facilities of this body. If this one gets killed in a battle, then they'll go to the heavenly planets. So to them, it doesn't matter. They know that they're eternal. They're going to be going on. So this means they have to be quite elevated in knowledge, and in training, self-control, all these different things. So we can see the Kshatriya is very, very special. When he fights with his foes in battle, let him not strike with weapons concealed in wood, nor with such as are barbed, poison, or the points of which are blazing with fire. So this is, the point is that the whole idea in battling between the Kshatriyas is the mood, the spirit of fighting. It's a rasa. And therefore, it should be very fair and just. So here, if weapons concealed in wood, then you can't see them, and then suddenly they strike with that, because it's not fair. It wasn't an equal battle. Nor with that which is barbed, because then it does more damage than it should. If it's a sharp edge or it's a blunt thing, it'll do a certain damage, but if it's barbed, then it rips and does other things, and that's not important. Poison means even you're not expert in the fighting, but then it will kill the other person. Nor points of which are blazing with fire, because then it creates also more damage than it should. Even if you just touch them, or you don't even create you're not very expert, but it still will make problem. So these things should not be done. This is in battle. You know, sometimes you see in politics, that's another thing. But in battle, then that Kshatriya spirit must be maintained. 91. Let him not strike one who in flight has climbed on an eminence, nor a... nor a eunuch, nor one who joins the palms of his hands in supplication, nor one who flees with flying hair, nor one who sits down, nor one who says, I am thine. So if someone surrenders, or they're very afraid and they're just running away, or like this, eunuchs, or like this, musicians, and all these, then they're left. It's just not. There's been even in battles that, another greater king was entering the he had gotten up to the palace and he defeated the palace, and so the palaces, according to the Vastu Shastra, they have different gates, and different gates are meant for different things. So at the time of when the palace is being taken, the fort is being taken, there's a gate out through which then all these, like this, the eunuchs and the musicians and the women and the kids go, and nobody can, no one will, will harm anybody who comes out of that gate. Because the Kshatriyas, they're going to stand to battle. They're not going to go out that gate. They're going to fight till the end. Or they're going to surrender and become subservient to that other king. Like that, and become vassals. Either part of his army, or that king will surrender and then he will pay tax or tribute to that more powerful king. So then, in one of these battles, then the king himself dressed up as a eunuch and then went out through that gate. And the stronger king, either he saw or his men saw, you know, his spies, and they informed him, and he said, let him go, because any Kshatriya can do that, you know, we're not going to bother killing. You know, he's good as a eunuch anyway, so he's already been insulted, so we don't bother with that, let him go. And then they just walk in and take the fort. So it's, in other words, the Kshatriya doesn't kill people who are not, you know, properly who have surrendered. Yes. 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 Yeah. Yeah. It was completely against the rule. It was completely against the rule. I had heard that Drona himself felt bad afterwards for it. I'm not sure if the others did, but he felt bad. Because, you know, it's not proper. Because the whole point is, it's not whether you win or lose. It's just that the Kshatriya spirit, the one is doing one's best. And it's up to Providence who's going to win or lose. That's already set. Now it's a matter of whether we do our duty or not. Point is whatever is going to happen is going to happen. Now, what is being seen by the Lord is what we're going to do in the situation. Right? Let's say we're going to go to Calcutta. And when we go to Calcutta, there's going to be problem. So now the Lord is going to see whether we depend upon Him and are surrendered to Him and remember Him, or if we're just upset and yelling and screaming and talking about this and that and, you know, and somebody blaming it on the whole universe. So the situation is going to happen, but now one is devotion and one's not. So we're going to see what we do with it. So the same way is, who's going to win or lose in the battle, that's already set. But now it's a matter of seeing what we do with that. And that is what is glorious. So it's the activity that's glorious. It's not the thing. That's very, very important. In the devotional service, the thing that's being offered is a medium for your own devotion or your own mood. So if you're offering something to the Lord, it's not what you offer. It's that mood in which you offer it. And then along with that, then if the thing you offered is something you know Krishna likes, then that pleases the Lord. But that is on top, that's another added thing of devotion. So it's still not the thing, but it's just that you have gone to the trouble to offer what Krishna likes. So he becomes very pleased. Like that. So that must always be remembered. The Abhideya, the activity aspect of the whole process, is what is elevating us. We have the goal, therefore we're always moving towards pure devotional service. And we know our relationship with the Lord, and we know the relationship of everything else with the Lord. Therefore everything becomes connected. That. So the mood is the most important. 92, as we go down, we can see how the battle, so many things were there. Nor one who sleeps, nor one who has lost his coat of mail, nor one who is naked, nor one who is disarmed, nor one who looks on without taking part in the fight, nor one who is fighting with another foe, nor one whose weapons are broken, nor one afflicted with sorrow, nor one who has been grievously wounded, nor one who is in fear, nor one who has turned to flight. But in all these cases, let him remember the duty of honorable warriors. Means they'll never kill such people. Therefore we see in the Battle of Kurukshetra is at the end it was getting a little wild, where they were breaking all these rules. They were going out at night, they were sleeping, and the Kshatriyas who were being attacked in their sleep, their whole point was, is you want to fight, fine, you know, but at least let me get a weapon and let me die as a Kshatriya. But I mean, while I'm sleeping, you come and kill me? It says, what is this? You know, I don't get to die as a Kshatriya, and you definitely aren't a Kshatriya. You know? Like that. So it got very, very low. You know? Abhimanyu, whose weapons were lost. 94. But the Kshatriya who is slain in battle, while he turns back in fear, takes upon himself all the sin of his master, whatever it may be. Sin of his master. I wonder if that means the person that's defeated him, or if he's working for somebody. It must be the person that's defeated him. Yeah, I would think that that's where it is, because otherwise a Kshatriya generally is his own master, you know. So this means this, yeah, who has mastered him, he takes on all the sin. '95, and whatever merit a man who is slain in fight may have gained for the next world, all that his master takes. So that means whatever charity, all good things that he's done in his life, that goes to the person who defeats him. '96. Chariots and horses, elephants, parasols, money, grain, cattle, women, and all sorts of marketable goods and valueless metals belong to him who takes them, singly conquering the possessor. '97. A text of the Veda declares that the soldiers shall present a choice portion of the booty to the king. What has not been taken singly must be distributed by the king amongst all the soldiers. So when the soldiers collect, then they must give some, you know, very nice items to the king. And what is not just singly done, somebody himself battles and he takes that, but they're all working together and they lay a siege and they therefore conquer, then whatever is gained there, the king must distribute amongst all the soldiers, you know, like that. So here we also see the point is that they wouldn't, pillage, you know, and just go into the place and burn and steal and this and that. They wouldn't do that. They would just go in and then nicely it would be distributed. So there's still discipline. There's no, Kshatriyas always work on discipline. So they don't. There's no undiscipline allowed. 98. Thus has been declared the blameless primeval law for warriors. From this law a Kshatriya must not depart when he strikes his foes in battle. Let him strive to gain what he has not yet gained. What he has gained let him carefully preserve. Let him augment what he preserves, and what he has augmented let him bestow on worthy men. Like that. So he must always be giving in charity, and when he, moves on, then these things must be left to people who are worthy. So since it has been gained with difficulty, it must be given to those who will understand its worth. Let him know that these are the four means for securing the aims of human existence. Let him without ever tiring properly employ them. Interesting. So these four, striving to gain what he has not yet gained, what he has gained let him protect, augment what he preserves, and what he has augmented let him bestow on worthy men. 101. What he has not yet gained let him seek to gain by his army. What he has gained let him protect by careful attention. What he has protected, let him augment by various modes of increasing it. And what he has augmented, let him liberally bestow on worthy men. So he's going to get so much wealth, and then he's going to deal with that wealth in such a way that it increases, it multiplies. And then because it's multiplied, now he will give in charity to worthy people. So this is there. Is that, in other words, you see that this can also be applied here. You want to apply it into your business, is that what you need, you must strive to get. When you get it, you must protect it. And what you have, you must invest it properly and multiply it. And when it multiplies, you must give in charity. So the same thing goes for the businessman. Just that he will be on the, what do you call it? The battlefield of the sales floor, right? It's between his salesman and the ladies that come to buy the saris, and then you see who wins. Let him be ever ready to strike, his prowess constantly displayed, and his secrets constantly concealed, and let him constantly explore the weaknesses of his foe. Because in the world of politics, point is, as we see, Yudhishthir is a good king. But we see so many other kings are not so good. Right? The Pandavas had 5 Aukshahinis on their side. And Duryodhana had, what, 11? So except for, you know, like Shalya, who was tricked by Duryodhana, it would appear that the others kind of preferred his side. So that means there's some problem there. So there are less actually proper righteous kings than there are, you know, righteous. So he must always be very careful. Or let's say they follow the rules. Like Jarasandha is very expert in following the Vedic literature. But he gave in charity to the Brahmins, very, very kindly disposed. We see that he was very cultured in his dealings with Bhima and Arjuna. And Krishna, when they came as Brahmins, he accepted them. You've come as Brahmins, I know you're Kshatriyas, but I will deal with you as Brahmins since you call yourself a Brahmin. Right? Like before it says you give charity to someone who calls himself a Brahmin, you get double. Because you're giving it to them because they have the title Brahmana. But it doesn't mean that it doesn't mean anything because they're not trained. So here he's giving that. He is giving in charity as Brahmins. The Shaligram worship is going on. He hosts them very nicely while they wrestle. They've come there to wrestle him, to kill him. But he hosts them very nicely. Makes a nice wrestling arena. They wrestle in the day. In the evening, they sit and they discuss and eat together and play chess and hear music and do all kinds of things like this. So we can see, very refined, very high class, but a demon, right? When we say asura bhava masrita, generally the example they give is Jarasandha. That he's a king. He is asura bhava. He's the mood of demon. So he must always be careful to see what is the politics going on, and he must keep those very well guarded, secret. And he must always be properly behaving so that people see that he has his prowess, he has his abilities, they're all there. But we always have to remember that these are all based on modesty and other self-control and other good qualities. So it's like Yudhishthir. Yudhishthir is very powerful, and he's always displaying that power. But it is in no way offensive. It's very attractive because of its purity. So that is what we always remember. Whenever we hear these things, therefore the Shastras show us, the Bhagavatam is perfect, because therefore it shows all these qualities manifest in Yudhishthir, Kritu, you know, Rishabhdev, then Rantidev. These are the people that it shows. So these are the kings, Priyavrata. These are the kings. This is what it's meant. It's not meaning some, you know, wild, you know, megalomaniac. It's just talking about those kind of personalities. So when we say leader, we mean that. So when we say manifesting their prowess, we mean that. That they always manifest the that they are willing and able to perform service of management and protection of those under them. Of him who is always ready to strike, the whole world stands in awe. Let him therefore make all creatures subject to him, even by the employment of force. So here is means that those who are within his domain, then they must be respectful to the king. Otherwise, if they're not, they don't respect the authority, the hierarchy of power, of authority, then that person is not very qualified, because ultimately the Lord is the supreme authority. So and Krishna says he is the monarch. In the Gita he says, it's one of his opulences, he is the monarch. So even Sanatana Goswami and his Brahmins will stand when the Nawab walks into the room, and the Nawab is not a very cultured person. So, but because he represents the Lord, he's respected. So those who can't respect, then they shouldn't stay in the kingdom. They should go to another kingdom where they can respect. A human being who can't respect authority has a problem, a severe problem, because that will ultimately go back to Krishna. Otherwise, one will always have respect and authority, and one will just learn from experience that one has to discriminate. But the concept of respect of authority, that is never dwindles. One can never lose respect for the concept of authority. So here, if someone doesn't respect, then, and they're not going to another kingdom, then he should make them respect by his dealings. It says even by force, if he must. So generally those who don't respect, and you have to use force, means those who don't respect and misbehave. They create trouble. So then force must be used. Because they won't create trouble if they have respect. Is that clear? Let him ever act without guile, and on no account treacherously. Carefully guarding himself, let him always fathom the treachery which his foes employ. So he shouldn't act treacherously, but at the same time he's no fool. Right? And he's not acting with, you know, some slyness and all this kind of thing. So these aren't proper. It's very straightforward. Though it may be hidden, but it's straightforward. You deal with the people how they have to be dealt with, but you don't deal out of that realm. They shouldn't be dealt with in an improper way. But he should always be on guard against what others who may be treacherous. So he must be always aware. 105. His enemy must not know his weaknesses, but he must know the weaknesses of his enemy. As the tortoise hides its limbs, even so let him secure the members of his government against treachery. Let him protect his own weak points. Yeah. So he's also got to see that the people working under him don't get into any of this, or get overwhelmed by the foe's treachery. This treachery will always be there. 106. Let him plan his undertakings patiently meditating like a heron. Like a lion, let him put forth his strength. Like a wolf, let him snatch his prey. Like a hare, let him double in retreat. When he is thus engaged in conquest, let him subdue all the opponents who he may find by the four expedients, consolation, and the rest. The four expedients means the, what is it? Sama, Dana, Beda, Danda. Sama is that you speak very nicely in all this. Dana is you offer position or some facilities or wealth. Beta is that you separate them off from the others, or you tell them if you don't do this, then this is going to happen. So the threats are there, and at the same time, as you let everybody else know that this person's not good, so that they don't side with him. So he's separated. He's alone. He has no strength. And danda. If that doesn't work, then they're chastised. And if the beta is done nicely, they'll have no support. They'll be left on their own. Like that. So in this way, he must deal properly. So mentioned in the Krishna book, the Krishna and Balaram, they learned all these things. The first thing that they learned in the Gurukul from Sandipani Muni, they learned all the shastras. And that, all the philosophy and these aspects. The second is they learned all the supplementary literatures. You know, your Sanskrit, astrology, and these kind of things, Dharma shastras. The third is they learned the vocational trainings of Kshatriyas. In other words, all these things. The whole political system and how that works. And then anything to do with that, their mathematics and their economics and whatever they had to learn. And then the fourth was they learned the arts, the fine arts. Like that. So these are also points that these four are mentioned by Prabhupada that Krishna and Balaram learned. 110. As the weeder plucks up weeds and preserves the corn, even so let the king protect his kingdom and destroy his opponents. That king who through folly rashly oppresses his kingdom will, together with his relatives, ere long be deprived of his life and his kingdom. So it mentions here, rashly oppresses his kingdom. Means in the kingdom he must oppress the rogues and thieves and rascals that give problem to everybody. Those are the foes in the kingdom. Then you have outside the kingdom, other kingdoms want to take over. But the foes in the kingdom he must take care of. But it says here, if he rashly, through folly, means through misunderstanding, through foolishness, lack of training, bad advice, bad association, if he oppresses his kingdom, then together with his relatives, they will lose their life, they will lose their position, and this will be quite common for them. It won't be that he'll get back another kingdom very soon, you know, not even in future life. So if he overly is strong with his own people, where to the point where they feel oppressed rather than protected. See, if discipline is good, one feels protected. It may be strict, but one knows it's just, one feels protected. But if it's oppressive, then one will lose position. One will lose his position. As the lives of living creatures are destroyed by tormenting their bodies, even so the lives of kings are destroyed by their oppressing their kingdoms. Okay, then it gets into how hell he'll govern. Are there any questions or anything on to hear? What time is it? What is the time? 35. No questions on this? Yes. Huh. Not so, I mean, you can see like that. That is there, but that's a positive dana. It's in the political, I mean, you have that. I mean, somebody does well, they're naturally rewarded and then taken care of. But here it also can mean is that there are persons who are only going to do things because they see material profit. So you have somebody who's making trouble, but you give him a position, then he stops making trouble. Right. There's a very famous one in the, I think it was pirates in the Mediterranean. I forget who was there, the Spanish or... They're having a lot of problem because this pirate would come and make so much trouble. So much trouble. Whatever they would bring through wealth, he'd just come and steal it. You know, kill the men, steal everything. It was a big problem for them. So one day, somehow or another, they caught him. And, you know, the natural thing would be to kill him. But then whoever is the admiral, he decided, no, no, don't kill him. Make him the commander of the Mediterranean on behalf of the throne. So they gave him, you know, army and ships and all that. And because he was the biggest of all the dacoits, he knew where all the small dacoits were. So he went and just collected them all and wiped them all out. So in this way, then, he protected the interests of the throne. He just wants wealth and position. So you give it to him, he'll work for the king. You know, and if he doesn't have it from this, he'll just make trouble. So such a materialistic person, it'll be used in that way. And someone who's very loyal, then naturally, that's affection. They're just taking care of. This is politics. Right? When you give someone out of affection something, it's not called politics. But when it's not out of affection, you know, it's just expedient, then it's called politics. Does that make any sense? Or? Anything else? Nothing else. This Samadatta Beta Danda means is that you'll always find is that you don't necessarily have a temple full of pure devotees. So the first thing when someone doesn't behave properly, you speak nicely with them and try to get them to understand and behave properly. Then if that doesn't go, if they have some abilities in all this, then they may be given some kind of position in which their nature may be engaged properly. So generally they make trouble because in this way, because they're interested in the whole managerial scene, but they're not working within it, so they work outside of it and make trouble. But if that doesn't work, you know, they goes to their head or they still make trouble, then it's beta. You tell them either you stop all this or you're going to be removed from the position or you're going to be punished or you're going to be sent out from this temple. Like that. That's beta. And then if that doesn't work, then whatever the chastisement will be, they'll be removed from that position. Whatever's been said, you must do. You can't not do it. You know, otherwise, why say it? You know, leader, he keeps his word. So if he said that if you don't stop doing these activities, and this will be the reaction, then that reaction must be given. So that's regularly going on. Means most understand the first, third, and fourth. The dana is a little bit not as well understood. It's not as much practiced. But a lot of people do. Those who are very expert in the material world, they use it quite a lot. You know, they see someone who's, you know, really got potential. Just get them on your side. You can get that person to work for you, then how much trouble he's giving you is that much benefit. Is going to be there. So it's used by those who know have that understanding. Anything else?
Would danda be always physical?
No, danda just means whatever the punishment is, the chastisement. So if it's like removal from a position, removing them from the position is danda. Like that. It says the rod of chastisement. So that means it'll be some form. Chastisement is there, whether it's verbal or it's position, facilities, or actually physical. Then that's depends upon the situation. Like that. So one has to be, it mentions here, the leader must be always ready to apply these. If he's not, then he'll be taken advantage of. If he's always ready, then everybody will have respect. That aspect is there. Respect it means that leadership ability must be shown. Leadership ability must be there. and nothing else. Okay, so we'll end here then. Om Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare.